Always expect something good on your lunch hour, connecting faith with life.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. I hope you're out enjoying this beautiful holiday weekend. I'm Joe Bender, and this is Connecting Faith. Welcome to our Independence Day edition of the show. And as we approach the celebration of our nation's independence, well, we thought it would be a great time to share some stories from those who have served in or have had family members serve in our military forces. So I'm excited today to have two guests on the show, one who's going to help us know how we can pray for our servicemen and women, and another who shares his inspiring story of serving as a medical professional in Iraq and how his faith was strengthened through that experience and much more. So I hope that today's show will both equip and inspire you on this 4th of July weekend and help you to celebrate our nation and our nation under God, and also encourage you to just be praying for those who are in the military. If you've always wondered, well, how can I do that and what would be a great way to pray for them? Well, you are in for a treat because my first guest is author Edie Milson. Let me tell you a little bit about her. Edie is a military family blogger for Guideposts. She is mother to a Marine and a popular speaker. She has just released her new book, Well, My Soldier Serves, this spring. Edie knows firsthand the struggles that facing military men and women and their loved ones as her son was deployed in Iraq for two tours. Her thoughtful book includes more than 100 specific prayers for every family soldier, prayers focusing on wisdom and strength, on faith, protection, encouragement, comfort for them, and also for their fellow warriors. So the book also includes 53 specific prayers for the ones who are at home, helping family members deal with emotions such as fear and loneliness and strengthen their patience, faith, and community ties. So it's a great resource, not only for those who are in the military, but also for families who have children who are in the military or loved ones. Well, Edie is a wife and mother of three sons, and we are grateful to have her with us today. Welcome, Edie.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
Well, I'm so grateful for the book. I was just mentioning as we were chatting before the show, because a lot of us just don't know how we can best support those who are making the sacrifice for our freedom by serving in our nation's military. We don't really know how to specifically pray for them or for moms and dads, moms like you who had your own children serving in the military. So thanks for writing it, because it really gave me some insight as to what specifically I can pray for. Why did you feel that it was necessary to put these prayers and put your thoughts down on paper?
Well, to begin with, when my son was first deployed, we don't come from a military background family. We don't live in an area with a military base. So there was a huge learning curve for us as far as getting our feet under us and learning how to cope with all of the things that were coming at us very quickly. And I searched for prayers to pray for my son, because I dealt a lot with fear when he was deployed. I was terrified that something would happen to him. And I wanted to be able to pray in strength and pray in faith. And so I looked for prayers that reflected some of the emotions I was feeling, and I couldn't find any. And so I began journaling my own prayers and going to the Bible and pulling out verses that ministered to me, that spoke to me, and using those to base my prayers on. And after I got through all of this, and our son has been out now for 4 or 5 years and gone on to other things, but I realized that there are still military families out there, people who love soldiers, and they need that kind of a resource. And so I pulled it together to be to take that was something that was a dark time for our family and to let God use it to help someone else out.
So if you don't come from a military family, then when you found out your son was going to be going on a tour, how was that day? Or even just entering the military, how did that affect you?
It was terrifying. It really, really was. I was not prepared at all. Fortunately, we live in a strong faith community, and there were people who reached out to us, but it was a struggle for me, a daily struggle, to realize that God did, in fact, love my son more than I ever could, and that my son was safe in God's hands. And it was just a daily surrender of turning him back over to God and saying, I'm going to walk in faith in this. And you know, some days I didn't so much walk as I crawled in faith. But, you know, God got me through it.
Well, the section that you have on protection, I expected to see some prayers on protecting your soldier physically, but I also saw just a great prayer of protecting his heart and mind as well. And I'm just going to read a little section of that so that our listeners can understand what your book is about and what they would receive if they decide to pick one up. Here it says, "Dear Lord, I want more than anything for my loved one to be safe. I long for the days when we're together, when I could protect him. I'm so proud of the man he's become, but it frightens me that I can't be there to keep him from harm. So now I'm turning him over to you. I know you've always been there, but even though I know you'll protect him, it scares me that I am not in control. Instead, I'm miles away. I want to be there physically to shield him, and not just from the physical dangers, but from the harm I know that comes to his heart and to his mind. Some days I worry more about his heart and mind than anything else. I hear of so many soldiers with problems after they come home and for years afterward. Please, God, protect him from that kind of trauma. Guard his mind and heart. Keep them whole and intact. I know from the Bible that you sometimes send your angels to stand guard against someone, around someone. Please send them to protect my loved one. Keep him safe from anyone or anything that would bring him harm. Amen." Edie, it sounds just so raw that you're writing in a way that your son, of course, is at the forefront of your mind, but you've so well, you've articulated it so that anyone can insert their loved one into this prayer as well. Tell me what it was like just to think, I'm out of control here.
It was terrifying. When my kids were little, I thought that my job as a mom was to protect them. I wanted to teach them about God and to equip them, but really and truly, I was thinking I'm protection. And I thought I was protecting them. And the fact that my son went away to war really just brought home the fact that although I can do certain things, really my children's protection is not part of my job description. That is really God's job description, and I was usurping that to a great deal. Now, a lot of times he uses parents to protect our children, but ultimately their safety, their well-being, the situations they're in, he's the one who brings about that protection. And so for me, it was just a constant battle with myself to get myself out of control and to acknowledge that it really was God in control. And that brought me peace because he really could affect the situation that my son was in, and I couldn't. And so the fact that he was in control was not a bad thing. It was a great thing. I just had to remind myself of that.
Well, and to realize that we don't even know what's going on. Even your son probably couldn't tell you everything that was going on, nor would he choose to. And the way you've laid out your prayers just kind of says, hey, you know what's going on, Lord, even if I don't know. And so you know how to protect him much more than I ever would.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So how did your son fare? I know he went on two different tours. Are you still praying for emotional and spiritual protection as he just enters back into civilian life and enjoys his life here?
I absolutely am. You know, I pray for God to erase some of the things that he's seen, for God to bring his viewpoint, his perspective to some of the things that our son went through. And, you know, it's an ongoing battle. It's difficult. A lot of veterans struggle a great deal more than our son does, but it's still, they've been through something that's very difficult, and God needs to give them the perspective that can bring about complete and total healing.
And this prayer, it's vital for not only those who are currently in the military, but for those who have come home and are working as well, is it not?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And their families as well. I mean, it's a time of readjustment for everybody. I often tell people when I speak, I wouldn't choose it, but I wouldn't change it. When I think about hard times that I've been through, I wouldn't go back and change that because I'm the person I am now because of what I've been through. And I pray that that can also be his prayer, that he can accept that God has brought good out of things that were difficult.
What was most helpful for you, Edie, as you were here at home and your son was off to war? Was it helpful to speak with other parents who had children in the military? Was it helpful? Was your church helpful? What was really a way that people could bless you in that time?
Absolutely. It helped that I could talk to other people who had been there, because there were certain aspects of the journey that were not intuitive, that I didn't understand was normal, and I felt abnormal, but talking with people would help me. One of the biggest things was, at times I would wake up in the middle of the night just drenched in sweat with night terrors and not be able to pray. And invariably, 100% of the time, I would hear from somebody, a church friend, an acquaintance, somebody in the community would contact me the next day and say, I wanted to let you know God woke me up last night and I prayed for your son. That was so comforting to me, to receive acknowledgement that other people were praying for him. That was the biggest thing, because I knew that none of us could really help from over here, but I knew that God could. And the idea that other people knew that and were praying as well gave me a great deal of peace.
I'm talking to Edie Melson today. She's a writer, a blogger, a teacher, and a very in-demand speaker. Most importantly, though, she writes that she's a wife and a mother of three sons, the eldest of whom enlisted in the Marine Corps and served two tours in Iraq before being honorably discharged. She continues to pray for him and has written some of those prayers down in her book, Well, My Soldier Serves, Prayers for Those with Loved Ones in the Military. We do have a few copies of Edie's book to give away, and if you are listening to the show today, we are recording this show, but we would love to get your name submitted. You can just go to myfaithradio.com, click on the Connecting Faith show page, and submit your name that way. We will draw for some winners at the end of the show today. So we hope you'll get one of those. Or otherwise, you can check it out at your local book retailer. Edie, we'll be right back after the break to talk more with Edie on her book, Well, My Soldier Serves. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Connecting Faith. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. We are celebrating our Independence Day this weekend, and as such, we are looking at how we can pray for our soldiers, the men and women who are in the military right now, and those who have been in the military, how we can continue to pray for them. I'm speaking with author Edie Melson today. She has written just a fabulous book called Well, My Soldier Serves, Prayers for Those with Loved Ones in the Military. And we've been talking about not only her son's tour, but also how you can pray for mothers and fathers of those who have children in the military as well. And I'm going to start by just reading one of her entries on faith. It says, Dear Lord, surround my loved one with those who will strengthen her faith. I know she's a strong woman, but even a strong believer will face times of doubt. During those times, give her comrades of faith. Let the fountain of belief inspire her. Use her fellow soldiers to remind her of your steadfast character. Give her strong examples of godly men and women to follow when her own faith wavers. Make sure she has close friends that she can share her struggles with honestly. Put commanders who rely wholly on you in charge of her unit. Let faith be a common topic of conversation. Keep her safe from anyone who would undermine the foundation of belief that she has in you. I know that you use others to speak to us, especially during times of doubt and difficulty. Speak to her clearly through the actions of those close to her. Most of all, show her that it's through difficulties that our faith is made strong. Amen. And that was just one excerpt from Edie's book, Well, My Soldier Serves. Edie, did you find yourself praying for your son's faith to be strengthened many times over, not knowing what he was facing?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It was so frightening to think about all of the different scenarios that could be happening, and to try to pray for him no matter what was coming up. And so I found that I went back to the foundation. I prayed for his faith. I prayed for his strength. I prayed for hope. I prayed for all of these different things that applied no matter what was going on in his life.
And why is it so important that as we're here in the States, we're maybe not thinking about everything that's going on, why is it so important that we continue to pray for the faith of our soldiers who may not have anyone to talk about with those faithful conversations that you mentioned in your prayer?
Well, I think it's vital because our soldiers are facing so much more than just physical situations. A lot of them are deployed in the Middle East, which is, you know, they're in hostile environments where nobody believes the same as they do. And so much can come into play in their minds, and so much of their well-being depends on them staying steadfast and focused, and their faith is foundational to that.
Well, and you also mentioned, I just found myself struck at how I haven't thought about so many things that soldiers face while they are not here. One of the things that you wrote about was financial worries. Your prayer says, relieve my loved one of financial worries back home. Something we don't often think about, but something that needs prayer as well. Talk a little bit more about that.
Well, absolutely, especially if the soldier is married. And if he's a reservist and they were used to a certain income level, then suddenly his income is cut because our military don't make a lot of money. Even with the bonuses they get for serving for combat pay, they still don't make a lot of money. And a lot of times you have a stay-at-home mom who has young children, and suddenly she is forced into the workplace, or they have to cut their salary by a third. And that can be devastating to someone. And even someone who is single, like our son, when he went over there, he was engaged, but he was single. But he still had bills that came due and different things like that. And he would call us or email us and go, oh, Mom, I forgot about this. Can you handle this? You know, there are a lot of things that they're out of touch, and they have to have someone at home who's willing to handle that. And it can be very much a distraction when these men and women do not need to be distracted.
What other areas do you find that people just don't realize about people when they are serving in the military, the things that kind of get left unsaid here at home that we need to be more aware of so that we can acknowledge the issues that people may have when they get back?
Well, I think one of the things is it goes along with the financial thing. Sometimes the soldiers are older and they have teenagers at home. I mean, what a blessing if a business would offer a part-time job to the mom of a soldier who's deployed, or the son or daughter of a soldier who's deployed. Maybe it's just mowing your neighbor's yard, but yeah, you might be able to do that, but maybe you could ask their son or daughter to do that and give them some spending money that they don't have, that they don't have access to. There's also the fact that when the soldier gets home, the family has been going through this financial hardship, and they don't have the resources to go and spend the day at an amusement park, or go out as a family to see a movie, or mom and dad the chance to reconnect at a hotel overnight without the kids. Mm. There's so many things that we can do to reach out to the military families in our midst. And a lot of times military families have what I call a bunker mentality. They tend to put on that stiff upper lip, and I'm strong, I'm going to be like my soldier, and I'm going to muscle through on my own. And so you have to reach out and say, can I do this for you, rather than just say, hey, if you ever need anything, give me a call.
Mm. That's true. Offering something specific, and then you can get a yes or no rather than a sure, I'll call you when I run into a problem, because that call usually doesn't happen.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, and a lot of times you've got a single or a suddenly single parent who has different places they have to be with different kids. And before they shared those duties, and now they need somebody else to step in and maybe take Sally to a dance recital while mom takes Joe to baseball practice, or, you know, there's just not enough parent to go around anymore.
As a mom of a son who served in Iraq, how did you find your faith was challenged most?
I think it was just the ongoing battle. It wears you down. They're not gone for a week or two. They're gone for 9 months to a year to 15 months. And it's just this daily battle. And it seems that everywhere you turn, your emotions are amplified because you're worried and you're stressed. Just, I think it's the fact that it goes on so long.
I was just asking a friend of mine, when do I stop worrying about my children, even if it's something so trivial as being in a tennis tournament that I don't get to see or something? And she just laughed and said, you will never stop, no matter how old they are, how far away they are, you will never stop worrying for them. Is that true?
That is absolutely true. And I think we see that reflected in God. He never stopped worrying about us.
Well, that's a wonderful thought and something I will remember as well, as I find it silly that I worry about trivial things when there are so much more important things like my son being in Iraq or serving for the military. How can we continue to pray this weekend just for and to thank people if we see people who not only are dressed in military uniforms, but also for those who may acknowledge that they were part of military service in any way? What would be a great thing to say to them as we see people this weekend?
I think it's always great to thank them for their service, but it's also great to remember those who are serving now with care packages or cards, or remember the people in our community who have loved ones who are serving, and maybe a gift card from some place to go out to dinner, or a casserole, or just a card that says thank you. There are also a lot of organizations that we can donate to, service dog organizations. There are so many servicemen and women who have come out of the military and who need the use of these service dogs. And it is incredibly expensive to get these dogs trained. And even just a little donation can help. It's also great if you can support your local Blue Star Mothers chapter. Blue Star Mothers of America is a national organization, a 501c3. We were chartered by Congress. And our mission is to support the troops as they serve and to support those who are left at home.
Edie, thank you so much for sharing your stories and your prayers with us and for helping all of us understand how we can pray for our military men and women, both those in active duty and those who have come home but are still deeply grieved by what they saw in war. If you want to learn more about Edie and about her book, While My Soldier Serves, you can go to ediemelson.com or just head to our website at myfaithradio.com and click on the Connecting Faith show page. Up next, a neurosurgeon's perspective on his experience in the medical tent in Iraq on our Independence Day edition of Connecting Faith. Well, welcome back to Connecting Faith on this celebration of Independence Day. I want to thank Edie Melson for sharing her wisdom on how to pray for our servicemen and women, and insight into how we can also pray for loved ones of those serving in our nation's military. Those who have served in our military agree that prayers are needed and wanted, not only for those in active duty, but also for those who've returned home and are still dealing with physical, emotional, and the spiritual aftermath of having been in war. So please continue to pray. And for more information on Edie Melson's book, you can go to our website at myfaithradio.com. For this half hour, we get to hear another perspective from one who has served in our armed forces, the story of a neurosurgeon who, as a major in the U.S. Air Force, left a successful practice in San Antonio to serve as part of a medical team that would perform surgery, even brain surgery, in the medical tents in Iraq. Let me introduce you to him, and we will hear more about his story. Dr. Lee Warren is a board-certified neurosurgeon and patented inventor mentor as well. He lives in Auburn, Alabama, with his wife and business partner, Lisa Warren, and their children. Dr. Warren has a B.S. in biochemistry from Oklahoma Christian University and an M.D. from the University of Oklahoma. He practices minimally invasive brain and spinal surgery, develops new technologies with his wife through their company, Warren Innovation, and is an affiliate professor of biomedical sciences at Auburn University. In his spare time, he plays guitar, writes songs, and recently completed his first novel, Kill Switch. You can visit Lee at www.leewarrenmd. I messed that up, Lee. You're going to have to tell me what that is. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Where can people learn more about you?
WLeeWarrenMD.com.
All right. Website. That was a tough way to start, but we are just so grateful that you've joined us for the show. You know, your story you placed in your book, it's called No Place to Hide, A Brain Surgeon's Long Journey Home from the Iraq War. And your story captures just a part of war that we don't often hear about, the view from a medical team's perspective. Tell us how you came to accept that offer to serve your country in this way and why you decided to say yes.
Well, the offer actually came years before when I accepted a scholarship from the Air Force to go to medical school. So I was paying back the Air Force for having educated me when I was in San Antonio from 2001 to 2005 after I finished my training. And then I was about 6 months from getting out of the Air Force when they notified me that I was being deployed to Iraq. So I was had my sights set on private practice and about to be a civilian after all those years in the military, and then all of a sudden I was going to war.
So what was that like when you first heard, well, it's happening now, and were you afraid, were you anxious, were you excited, or maybe all of those things?
You know, all of them, but it was a really difficult time in my life and in my family's life. My brother actually had a stroke and was in heart surgery having a valve replaced from this infection that had caused his stroke when my phone rang. We were in the waiting room while he was having heart surgery, sitting right next to my mom, when my commander called me and told me I was going to Iraq. So it was a really stressful time for my family. You know, my brother was sick, and now I'm going to war, and all of that was happening at the same time. So there was a lot of trepidation and fear and all those things, as much as the excitement of having an opportunity to serve my country.
Well, when I think of neurosurgeons, I think of what might be required to have a successful procedure, things that would make maybe a more favorable situation for achieving a desired result, like proper instruments, a sterile environment, good light, a trained and equipped medical staff. And then when I think about a medical tent in Iraq, I'm thinking that maybe some of those things did not exist. Am I getting kind of an accurate picture?
You are. Neurosurgeons we're sort of control freaks. We work with, you know, lasers and computers and really high precision kinds of things, and we're used to having everything we want when we need it, and the situation in Iraq was different. You know, you had a real supply resource issue because you could only take so much equipment. And so we basically had to plan on what we thought we might have, and we only had a little bit of it. So went from, you know, excess of being in an American hospital where you have everything all the time to literally being in a tent with dirty floors and four sets of instruments. So if something broke or didn't work, you had to wait a while to get it replaced. So it was quite a resource management lesson.
So tell me about what a typical day might be, or I'm guessing there weren't a lot of typical days, but what might be a traumatic experience for you or for the people that you were serving while you were there?
Well, the biggest thing was this notion that you were, as an individual, that you weren't necessarily safe all the time. So we were being mortared and rocketed every day. It was, at the time, Balad Air Base was the most attacked military installation in Iraq, and we had received an average of one rocket or mortar landing on the base every single day while I was there. So you had this idea that, you know, you were in a dangerous place with people who wanted to kill you, and then we were working almost 24 hours a day, and so anywhere in Iraq when something blew up or somebody was injured or there was a battle, they had an average of less than 1 hour response time to have that person from the injury site on the battlefield to the hospital. And so we would, you know, be just walking around the hospital and all of a sudden get a call that we had 20 or 30 injured people that would be there in 10 minutes. And so we would go from, you know, not doing anything, checking email, to being overwhelmed with 30 blown up, bleeding, dying people, some of whom were Americans and some of whom were Iraqi civilians and some of whom were enemy al-Qaeda terrorists or insurgents. And so you would have to then organize a very efficient way to triage those people, figure out who needed the resources that we had available to us first. We only had four operating rooms, and each of those had two surgical tables, so we could operate on a maximum of eight people at a time. We only had one CAT scanner, for example, so if there were a bunch of people that appeared to have head injuries or abdominal injuries that needed CAT scans, we had to literally decide which patient needed to go first. And sometimes that resulted in somebody else dying while the other person was getting their scans. And that just doesn't happen really in the United States. And when we think about triage in America, it's usually, you know, there's 20 people in the ER with stomach aches, and which one gets to see the doctor first? Mm-hmm. It's usually not life or death kind of triage. And in Iraq, it was. And the hardest part about that was that all of us, that all the medical people were new at this. You know, none of us had ever been to war before. And so we were kind of learning on the fly in a very austere environment how to do these things to try to save lives.
So how did that kind of mess with your head, really, knowing that you yourself were in danger, and then you were also trying to keep someone else from danger, and you had to learn that all at once versus someone going through basic training, kind of preparing their minds and hearts for what they were about to encounter, and yet you just started right in?
Yeah, it was really difficult, and I think it was difficult for all the reasons you said, but also just because most of us in the Air Force Medical Corps actually never thought we would be deployed, especially the subspecialists, like the neurosurgeons. Like the doctrine at the time was there were only 12 neurosurgeons in the Air Force, and since the Vietnam War, none of them had ever been deployed to a combat hospital. The theory was if you were hurt bad enough to need a brain surgeon, you weren't going to survive long enough to get to one. So they had told us our entire career that we would never be deployed. So when I got that phone call in August of 2004 that I was going to Iraq, it was shocking to me because we didn't even have the infrastructure or the paradigm that we might be someday going there. So then, you know, a few months later, there I was. And I think that was a kind of dramatic paradigm shift in our heads was, okay, not only are we going, but when we get there, we don't know what to expect because nobody's done it before. The Air Force has never sent anybody over there. So they sent a gentleman named Pete Linderson, who's a neurosurgeon now in Colorado. He went in September of 2004 as the first combat-deployed neurosurgeon in the United States since Vietnam, and I was second. So I followed him 4 months later.
Well, let me back up a little bit. One of the things you mentioned just in a previous comment was that, and I found interesting in your book, is that in addition to serving and saving and operating on the U.S. soldiers who were injured, you also operated on Iraqis, whether those be civilian or soldiers or your enemies. How did that, was that a surprise to you? Did you expect that? And how did that play out in under your tent?
It was a surprise to me. I actually thought that it would be an all-American, you know, or all-coalition situation. I never thought of the idea that we'd be treating the enemy. And the first time it was difficult. And one of the first patients I treated was identified as the person who had set this bomb off that injured all the soldiers that were there. And here we are having to treat him. And it was kind of difficult. And I noticed after we took care of him that for several days that the nurses and the doctors and the orderlies and everybody kind of treated this gentleman as a little sketchy. You know, we were all nervous around him and we didn't exactly know how to behave around him because he was the enemy. And then an amazing thing happened where some soldiers came in and they had actually identified the real bomber and had figured out that the guy that they told us was the bomber was actually just an innocent bystander. He was just an Iraqi who happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. And it was amazing to me to see how people changed their body language and changed the way they touched this man and changed everything about how they cared for him, because now they thought of him differently because they had better information. And that all of us kind of huddled around that concept and realized that you don't really know somebody's story unless you're there. And we just made it, I made a decision, we all sort of made our own decisions, that we were going to treat everybody equally, love and respect, and do our best for them, and let the soldiers sort everything else out. And that made a difference for me, because it set me free to realize that, you know, I've done some things wrong in my life too, and I don't want everybody judging me and treating me poorly because they think something of me. I just want to be taken care of. And so that really set us free to love and treat the enemy like Jesus would expect us to.
Wow, that's just an amazing statement as I think about what you must have been going through and the snap decisions that you would have to make in that situation. Did you find that all of the medical personnel shared this belief? Did you come to share it together, or were there even discussions surrounding that?
There were a lot of discussions about it, and there were some challenging situations later on, but I think for the most part, all of us came to grips with that it was our job as medical providers to care for the patient that was handed to us. And, you know, that's something that we do encounter in civilian world once in a while. As a neurosurgeon, I've treated a few people who, you know, a few babies who were shaken, you know, by their caregivers, and then you have to go out and interact with those family members, and you still have to provide support for them and care for them. And so I think as we went through the process, we had to draw a line in the sand that we weren't the people who made the decisions about who we treated. We just treated who got there in front of us. And the challenging ones were when we knew for certain that a person had set off a firebomb that killed a baby, or, you know, when we knew 100% that this guy was a terrible, guilty terrorist. It was difficult, but we still had to do it. And I just kept holding on to the idea that I might not actually know the whole story, and that helped me.
Well, and isn't there a chance that if you help those individuals who are in your care for that time and they return to their homes, that they might speak well of Americans?
I think so, and that's one of the things that I hoped and I prayed about a lot is, you know, if these guys have been raised in a culture where they're told that Americans are all evil and we're the great Satan and, you know, we're infidels and all of that, if they see something different from their interactions with us, then maybe somewhere somebody breaks the cycle of hate. Maybe a guy, you know, stands up and says, hey, you know what, I was in that American hospital and they treated me well and they were kind to me, and it wasn't like you said it was going to be. We had that hope, and I don't know how that played out, but we hope that some of those guys have a different story than they were raised to believe.
Well, today I'm talking with author and medical doctor W. Lee Warren. He is a neurosurgeon who spent 120 days in a hospital in Iraq, treating, of course, American soldiers, also Iraqi soldiers. We're talking about his experience that he has written down in his book, No Place to Hide, A Brain Surgeon's Long Journey Home from the Iraq War. We're going to chat more with Lee when we come back after this quick break. But if you're listening and you'd like to get your hands on one of his books, well, Lee and his publisher have both been very generous in donating several copies to give away. If you'd like, you can just go to our website at myfaithradio.com, click on the Connecting Faith show page. You can enter your name there and email, and we will put your name in a drawing to receive one of those books. We'll be right back to talk about the book No Place to Hide, coming up on Connecting Faith. Welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm Joe Bender, and talking today with Dr. Lee Warren, who served 120 days as a neurosurgeon in one of the hospitals in Iraq during active duty. And Dr. Warren, can you tell me a little bit more about what was going on in your own life? Your book is just so vulnerable because you talk about your family life as well as your experiences in Iraq and how they kind of melded together. Your family life was struggling even before you left, and then add to that the stress of being away from them in a dangerous war. How did your relationships fare in the midst of your time when you were in Iraq?
Well, as I wrote about in the book, I was at the end of a 16-year marriage when I went to war. I felt like actually I'd been kind of in a war in my personal life before I went to the actual war. In some ways, it felt like a relief almost to be deployed. I was going through all that with my brother nearly dying. My grandfather passed away 2 weeks before I deployed, and then I was right on the verge of a divorce, and I was really in a bad place in my faith and in my heart and just in my whole life when I went off to war. So I've seen now in hindsight that, you know, God used my time in the desert to sort of strip away this notion that I was in control of my own life and that I had to, you know, kind of white-knuckle my own existence, and that he intended to teach me to hold on to him when the bombs were falling and everything was difficult, that I was supposed to lean in on him and not try to control everything on my own. So for me, the personal life issues were really magnified as I was deploying, and then in the process of being kind of blown apart in my personal life and then literally by the war, I kind of landed in a place where I didn't have a choice but to fall back into faith with God.
You know, you write a lot about those lessons that God taught you from that wartime experience, and I think a lot of people would resonate from that white-knuckle control that we all seem to want to have, and then God continues to let us be in situations where we have to let go, whether it's for you dealing with inadequate supplies or conditions or having to submit and give your family over to him while you were away, or even just having to give up that feeling of being safe, which is hard for us as Americans to understand unless we've been in war. Why do you think that this lesson of giving up control was so difficult for you?
Well, I think it partly has to do with what I do for a living. You know, there's so much in neurosurgery that you just can't let anything slip. If you're taking out a brain tumor or trying to clip an aneurysm, you can't make a mistake. Like if you make a mistake, somebody dies or somebody's paralyzed. And so that kind of bleeds over into your whole life of, you know, thinking that you have to actually make every decision and control every aspect of everything or everything will fall apart. And the problem with that worldview is that it doesn't leave any room for God. You know, if I have to control everything, then I can't have a Lord if I'm the Lord of my own life.
Well, and it seems like sometimes we do need to be in a desert situation, you literally, but many of us have to be in a desert situation before we finally get that message. Did you find that to be true for you?
Absolutely. I think it was, most people probably aren't as hard-headed as I was. They can be in a metaphorical desert. I had to be in a literal one. You know, I think it was the process of kind of stripping away everything that I was used to, the notion that I had access to every kind of tool and machine that I needed, that I had as much blood as I needed for my patients, or that I had, you know, the ability to buy whatever I needed in America in my own life. All of that was gone in the war. You basically had what you were deployed with. You had the clothes even on your back were what you were told to wear. There was no place where you were in charge of your own decisions. And then the day that it all came to the head for me was when I decided to walk across the base to go get some supplies without my body armor on, because we'd been a day or two without having been mortared, and I thought, well, I'll just run across here, take a shortcut, and in my workout clothes, I got about halfway across the base in a place where there were no bunkers when a mortar attack happened, and for the next hour or so, I basically huddled up against a little concrete wall and prayed that I wouldn't get blown up while 12 or 13 mortars landed pretty close around me. And that was when I basically agreed that I wasn't in charge of my own life anymore. Mm. And that's actually where the title of the book came from, and No Place to Hide. I was stuck in the middle of this exposed area with no place to go. And I really felt like that was the moment when God said, hey, it's going to be okay. I'm going to take care of you. And the most important thing I think I can tell people is when you get to that place in your life, it's not a magic trick, and it doesn't mean that God's going to immediately make all your problems go away, because he didn't do that for me. You know, I had this sense that I was going to be all right if I trusted him. And I continued to see terrible things, and I went home, and the divorce went through anyway, and, you know, my life didn't magically put itself back together, but I had this peace that I had never experienced before in my life. And that sounds kind of cliche, Joe, but it's really true that once you lay down your own sense of control and you allow Christ to be your Lord, He can you can be in the storm, but the storm doesn't have to be in you anymore. Hmm. And that's what happened to me.
So as you have the opportunity now to kind of review your story and to look at the life that you've built with your family and how you work as a medical professional now, what do you think the Lord has done to change you? What change seems to be most apparent as you look back on your life after returning from Iraq?
Well, I'll tell you what it is. It is the ability to weather difficult times and not give up. That's the number one thing. Because I thought for the long period of time as I started writing, I thought that my story was to teach other people, you know, what I learned in the war. And then in 2013, we lost a child, and our son died, and he was a teenager. And I realized that all of that that I had been through was for God to prepare me to be able to survive what I was about to go through. And so I can tell you with no doubt that, you know, losing a child is worse than anything you go through in the war or any other part of your life. But if you take the lesson that I wrote about in that book about learning where to hide when everything is blowing up in your life, you can survive anything. You really can, and God will be faithful to you if you can hold on, even in the worst moments. He will be faithful. That's Psalm 34:18, where He says, "The Lord is close to the brokenhearted." When you're at the worst place in your life, that's true, if you let Him be in charge.
Mm-hmm. That's just beautiful and such a good, great perspective, especially to look back after what you have seen and then what you went through with your personal life. It did seem like there was kind of a perfect storm there for a bit. Well, your life in here in America does seem to have experienced a bit of restoration. Is that true?
It has. I met my perfect partner for me. I met Lisa Warren, and well, it wasn't Warren then, obviously. But I met Lisa, and we married, and we've put our families together in a beautiful way, and our kids love each other and grew up together, and of course, and when we lost our son in 2013, the whole family was there together to deal with that, and we've learned how to thrive in spite of the fact that life always brings war to you, and it will. It'll continue to bring war, but you can thrive anyway if you learn where to hide when the bombs are falling.
Mm. Well, as people listen to your story, they get your book, what do you hope that they can really know to be true about war, and also what can they know to be true about God?
Well, the number one thing is, I think, like I said, I think that it is always true that life will be difficult, but it's more true that God will be faithful no matter what difficulties you experience. So if people can take from my story that despite your circumstance, you can be happy and you can still be okay if you hold on to the Lord, I think that's the number one lesson. The secondary thing is, I think it's a really great opportunity for people to see a side of the war and the United States military that they really don't get anywhere else. I mean, we're used to SEAL Team 6 and American Sniper and all the combat stuff, but there's not a lot of education out there about what 99% of our deployed troops go through, and that's what's happening inside the bases, inside the hospitals. And I would love for people to understand some of the great work that's being done by those folks. And I think lastly, on the medical side, I think it's really interesting and educational for people to understand, you know, that we take care of the bad guys, that the United States delivers care to everybody, and that our medical people are outstanding. And I think there's just a lot of good things there that people can learn that they might not get anywhere else.
Well, the book is called No Place to Hide. I hope you'll check it out. It gives great insight into what our servicemen and women go through to protect our freedom. Lee, we're grateful for your service, for all of the lives that you protected and saved as a surgeon in Iraq, but also for the lives that you're affecting now just by telling your story, in hopes that we might fully understand how the Lord is active in the wartime situations and in each of our lives as well. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Joe. Appreciate being with you. God bless.
Thank you, and have a wonderful 4th of July. May God bless your day today and always. Thanks for listening to Connecting Faith.